Hi everyone, Matt Welch here. Welcome to The Reason Podcast. Today I have the pleasure of sharing with you a stimulating conversation with the most decorated conservative newspaper columnist in America, George Will. Will, who's been writing a syndicated column for The Washington Post for nearly a half century, quit the Republican Party in June 2016 after then-House Speaker Paul Ryan endorsed Donald Trump for president. He's been a persistent thorn in Trump's side ever since. But even while lamenting what he has called our authoritarian moment, Will has not abandoned conservatism. To the contrary, in his career-punctuating new book, The Conservative Sensibility, he makes the forceful argument that classical liberalism, based on natural rights and the political philosophy of James Madison, is the correct path forward not just for the GOP, but for a country that for too long has bought into Woodrow Wilson's progressive, White House-centric vision of government. I caught up with George Will the week his book came out. So, George Will, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on a terrific and, I think, a consequential book.
Thank you.
In our year 2019. So you've been writing this thing for a long time now. I seem to recall nearly 10 years ago you referring to this. You might have made a mordant joke about it being a eulogy.
Closing argument, except I'm not going anywhere.
Situate this, if you can, within the context of your own career, a half a century in Washington writing about this stuff, but also why in 2019 we need to be talking about the kind of pitched battle between James Madison and Woodrow Wilson.
Well, those two Princetonians are the polar opposites, in a way, of our political argument. Madison said, first, we believe in natural rights, which is to say, first come rights, then comes government. Government is instituted, in the most important word in the Declaration, to secure our rights, not to give us our rights, but to protect them. An inheritable limiting of government, in the very definition of it. This was fine until Woodrow Wilson came along and became the first president to criticize the American founding, which he didn't do peripherally. He did root and branch. He said the Madison's constitutional architecture with its Newtonian equilibrium between the branches, interestedness, combating interestedness, was fine, he said, when there were 4 million of us and 80% of us lived within 20 miles of Atlantic Tidewater. But now, he said, we are a great nation united by steel rails and copper wires, and, most important, we have reached a point of enlightenment that we don't need to worry about factions anymore because there's a broad consensus. Furthermore, Wilson came along when science was in the air, Marconi, Ford, Edison, the Wright brothers, and the idea of applying science to society as well as to the hard sciences caught their imagination. Furthermore, to get an advanced degree in the United States in the second half of the 19th century, you had to go to Germany to get it. And there were lots of people did, and they fell in love with the German state, the Hegelian idea of a disinterested bureaucracy. It would be a long time before public choice theory came along and said, it's not disinterested. It's a faction itself. Government is its own faction and interest group. But all this came together, and when Woodrow Wilson said we need a more nimble government, he used that phrase, one that can act with dispatch and force of a sort that is simply impossible under Madison's architecture. It flowed from that we had to have presidential government, that Congress should be marginalized. We didn't realize how energetically it would marginalize itself, reversing Madison's prediction that in a democratic society, all power is sucked into the legislative vortex. Actually, the legislature expels powers so it can get on with the two business of life, which is to A, avoid responsibility by allowing the essentially legislating to be done by administrative agencies, and B, to get reelected. So that's where we are. We have a rampant presidency. We have a hollowed out, supine, boneless Congress. And no one's happy.
It strikes me in reading some of the excesses of the progressive era, right? Teddy Roosevelt, you also sort of single out. Yes. early on, and we have no trouble in figuring out, oh, you know what, prohibition of alcohol was a disaster, it's a terrible idea, or the eugenics that a lot of progressives embrace, including both Roosevelt and Wilson in their own ways. That was just a terrible aberration and some other things. But the overall critique of the kind of scientism, the bureaucracy, didn't stick in a similar way. It's as if you could just jettison the nasty parts right. without a thorough going. Was there a failure of identifying this, or have we just sort of forgotten that there were critiques of that at the time and they just lost the argument?
We've forgotten. Historical amnesia is, de Tocqueville said, a systemic problem of democracies, forward-looking at all times. And we have forgotten it. And we've, as you say, we're going to keep the good parts of progressivism, but the good parts of progressivism bear a family resemblance to the bad parts, which is a kind of overbearingness. In Hayek's terms, a misapplication of the confidence and the hubris, if you will, of the hard sciences when applied to the complexities of a society of spontaneous order. In his wonderful Nobel lecture, Hayek makes this point, and he makes the call for epistemic humility, epistemology being the branch of philosophy that tells us how we know things. And he says, most of us can know very little about what's around us. Every day we get more ignorant relative to what there is to know, but markets, which are nothing but mechanisms for generating and aggregating information, make us smarter if we will listen to them. The problem is there's been a constant desire not to listen to markets for lots of reasons.
You mentioned Hayek here. The book is filled with people who I would describe as libertarian heroes. Milton Friedman, there's Virginia Postrell, there's Deirdre McCloskey, there's Ilya Soman, there's Randy Barnett, there's the Institute for Justice. It's dedicated to Barry Goldwater. And the book is called The Conservative Sensibility. Yes. Why is it called The Conservative Sensibility?
Because conservatism, rightly understood in America, is the legatee of classic liberalism. Liberals long since turned on their own tradition of limited government, resistance to authority. And conservatives took that over. Barry Goldwater, I cast my first presidential vote for Barry Goldwater. He lost 44 states, but I've always said he actually won. It just took 16 years to count the votes when Reagan came in. But Barry Goldwater came from a new part of America, the Southwest. There was nothing out there when he was born. When he built his house on a little hill where, as a young man, he used to ride his horse and sleep under the sky. There were 100,000 people in the Valley of the Sun then. To now, there are about 4 million. It's a place without a past. So he gave us a kind of libertarian bent, a leave-me-alone kind of Western conservatism, which is in direct conflict in 2019 with the European import. It's one of the grim paradoxes of our current moment. The people who say their purpose is to make America great again want to do that by importing European conservatism. Blood, soil, throne and altar, ethnicity, language, all that stuff that gives a particular identity, which they want to preserve. European conservatism was about defending hierarchies and established institutions and order. American conservatism is reconciling people to a constant churning, to the radical openness of a society of spontaneous order.
This is great, you know, dynamism in Virginia Postrell's term, and I think you use it in the
book.
What
I love about it, she said the most wonderful thing. I think it's in the book, I know it is. She said, the Bible, reduced to one sentence, is God created man and woman and lost control of things. Now, the conservative sensibility says, good, we don't want control. That's the whole point. The anti-conservative sensibility says, oh, it's dangerous, it's tiring, it's worrisome. And it's this anti-conservative hostility to the constant churning of a free society that I am afraid is about to produce what I'll call the big flinch. People saying, freedom was all right once, it's just too stressful, it's wearying. And along comes Walmart and destroys our lovely little hardware store. all of this. That's what protectionism is today, is an attempt to say, enough, we've had it, we're going to hunker down. The problem is, the American people, whether they know it or not, and they don't, have already made a choice. When they decided to have an entitlement state, Medicare, Medicaid, and all the rest, they decided that they're going to make these enormous promises to themselves, enormous calls on the future productivity of the country. They'd better attend to the future productivity. So they are wedded to economic dynamism, whether they know it or not.
As you sort of referenced, the kind of upper hand right now, since we have an overly presidential system, whatever the president is kind of the definition, the modern definition of what conservatismism or progressivism, or however you might put it, is. And right now, classical liberalism is a dirty word. I mean, we spent the last 10 days in the conservative commentary of people just scratching each other's eyeballs out over the difference between a kind of Catholic integralism and classical liberalism. I haven't seen the word, that term, used as much in the past 10 days than I have since the last time libertarians tried to not describe themselves as libertarians and using classical liberalism itself. Are you in a sense trying to make the Reagan argument in 1976? He said to Reason magazine, of all places, that the heart and soul of conservatism is libertarianism. Are you trying to say that, yes, you're about to lose this concept, and if you don't watch out, you're going to drive out those people from what should have been and is a noble tradition?
Classical liberalism was born in resistance to established churches, entrenched hierarchies, all of that. And it is it defines itself in reaction against potentially and often actually oppressive institutions. So there is that liberty gene, if you will. It's in the genome of American conservatism.
And yet it's on the run as we speak and being rapidly forgotten. I mean, here's the critique from the people who are railing against classical liberalism, and sometimes rail against you in particular, is that we're in a fight. This is a Flight 93 election.
You
don't like that metaphor?
I despise it.
Well, let's have an interjection of why do you despise that metaphor. I do too, but I'm curious to hear your reason.
Because we bandy promiscuously the idea of a crisis. We're not in a crisis now. Things are messy now. I get that. But we've had one constitutional crisis in this country, and it was April 1861, when the institutions could not handle the forces loose. And we had 4 years of saturation of blood, and we got over it. Watergate wasn't a crisis. Watergate was misbehavior, and we tidied it up. I mean, what is the crisis? Are these people, we have a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, and it's a rather young, about to be there. What is the crisis? I just don't get the hysteria built into the language.
Well, I mean, part of what your book does talk about is kind of in the disintegration of the family.
Yes.
There are indices that are unhappy right now, and also that are resistance to easy kind of solutions or even prescriptions of how we get there. Is there something in the, because I share the same thing. Oh, it's not a crisis. Look at the last 30 years have been the most unprecedentedly prosperous time in American or in world history in ways that language is not even, we don't have enough language to talk about how wonderful that is. But is there something in that triumphalism that has missed a hole at the center of the enterprise? And that hole is something that you see nationalists, not just in this country, but around the world, are eager to fill up.
Well, they're two very different things. One is some people have been casualties of the very process that has enriched the majority. And the casualties are resentful, which is understandable, and they should be helped as much as possible. Granted. On the other hand, there's another critique of classic liberalism that is profoundly dangerous, and it is that it doesn't give me meaning in life. It's a politics doesn't intoxicate me. It doesn't fill me with a sense of worth and identity and mission. Good. We've had quite enough of political movements that were going to deliver all of those things. New Soviet man, new Aryan man, this, that, and the other thing. politics shouldn't be that important.
Part of what is interesting in the middle section of your book is that you talk at least a little bit about your Statecraft to Soulcraft book from 30 years ago or so, and refute part of it. You say that I got something wrong, and I think part of, and correct me my characterization here, but that you underestimated the way in which the architecture of the Constitution was in itself Soulcraft, yeah. That it created a sort of a template for the creation of kind of a virtuous society or a society that could become self-governing, and that you underestimated yeah. that. Talk about that, but also maybe in the context of this, which is that your argument, you're making a very robust Madisonian argument and against progressives. Progressives' claim is that this is old-fashioned stuff, it's out of date. Isn't on some level the fact that you need to make this argument, in fact, that you need to make this argument to Republicans, maybe a sign that the progressive critique might be onto something. Like, it's the architecture didn't work. Like, some of the planks have been pulled out of the ship, and it's just not making as much sense anymore.
My book is, among other things, a summons to intelligent pessimism. Not fatalism. Nothing's inevitable. But problems are probable. There's so many ways things can go wrong. A free society, a democratic society, is not the default option of the human race. Takes construction. It's a famous paradox that laissez-faire is a government program. It needs courts, it needs contracts, it needs protection against fraud, adjudication, arbitration, all the rest. Complex network to produce freedom. I got that. But on the off chance that some of your viewers have not recently reread Statecraft to Soulcraft, which was read by dozens when it came out, let me refresh them. 1981, I give the Godkin lectures at Harvard, and it became a book called Statecraft as Soulcraft, and the subtitle is important, What Government Does. Not what government should do, but what it cannot help but do. My thesis was that by its structure of laws, by the economic system it chooses to create, by lots of things, it changes, sets out to change the soul of America, the soul of the citizens. The argument between the anti-federalists and the federalists was ostensibly about government. It was about government. It was about what kind of people we're going to be, what kind of Americans we're going to be. Jefferson really wanted a sort of stable, self-perpetuating rural yeomanry forever that would produce people rather like Thomas Jefferson. Hamilton said, "Not on your life." I want restless, entrepreneurial, upwardly mobile, constantly churning people rather like Alexander Hamilton. Well, fair enough. A little special pleading didn't hurt. But they were arguing about the kind of people we were. And what I got wrong in Statecraft of Soulcraft is I did not realize the extent to which the system we had in terms of government would shape the kind of people we are. And most important, what I missed was the extent to which capitalism itself is Soulcraft. It's a wonderful passage in de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. He's traveling down in the 1830s, the Ohio River. On his left is slaveholding Kentucky, torpid, no energy, no progress, no sound of enterprise. On his right is Ohio. Bustling, crackling with energy, people producing, getting wealthy, and all the rest. And there you had it. A certain kind of capitalism doesn't just make us better off, it makes us better. It enforces certain virtues, thrift, industriousness, deferral of gratification, individual aspiration and flourishing. That's Soulcraft.
You have a pretty withering chapter in there about foreign policy. The series of monsters that we've gone in search of destroying, and also, I think in a pretty interesting way, kind of talking about the an attempted application of the same natural rights philosophy that you were defending in the book to the world. Since Iraq people have the same aspirations and natural rights as we do, we're going to make that happen at that point of a gun. What do people get wrong in applying this thing here?
There's an inherent tension in American foreign policy that will never be and should never be gone, in my judgment. We are a creedal nation. We're a nation dedicated to a proposition, as Lincoln said, dedicating a cemetery. We are a nation made, as Margaret Thatcher said, by philosophy, unlike European nations that she said are made by history. And our philosophy is that, to all minds unclouded by superstition, that's what self-evident means, the self-evident truths are that individuals are rights-bearing and government should facilitate the exercise of their rights and get out of the way. Now, the question is everybody ready at all times for this? The answer is no. George Bush, borrowing a line from Ronald Reagan, said it is cultural condescension to say that the Iraqis are not ready for democracy. It was condescending, and it was true. That's more to the point. I've made this analogy in the book. Go to spring training, a manager will say, my team's just two players away from the World Series. Unfortunately, they're Ruth and Gehrig. Iraq was just about three or four people away from perfection, from being ready. They needed a Washington, a charismatic founder of a republic. He needed a Madison, a genius of constitutional architecture to enable factions with which Iraq was replete to live together. Needed a John Marshall, someone who could construe a constitution ably over the years and apply it to shifting circumstances. You needed an Alexander Hamilton who understood the political economy of a nation. And you needed the social soil of the Atlantic coast of the United States in the 18th century, from which people like that emerged in something like profusion. So, the tension in our policy is we're on the side of the world's embrace of our creed because we think it is self-evidently true. But not tomorrow, not everywhere now. And that requires prudence. That's what, I mean, prudence is the fundamental political virtue because it means applying principles to messy circumstances. That's all.
One person who, in modern politics, who I would say on some level agrees with the foreign policy, like litany of mistakes that you spell out there, Vietnam, Iraq, other kind of nation building exercises, and you might bristle at this, is Donald Trump, comparatively speaking, compared to a lot of politicians out there. He ran against Iraq and said, this is a bad idea. Yeah, I just saw him, this morning in England or last night, talking about his own avoidance of Vietnam, saying, I was never a fan of that war, which is a super crude thing for an American president to say. Also, a correct judgment, at least in my point of view. Is there an argument that Trump is a, you use the metaphor of like a breaking up the crust around a cake a few times in the book. Is Trump, could he be that in that forcing conversations about foreign policy, for example, that wouldn't otherwise exist? To add another completely different topic of that, you talk about judicial restraint and judicial engagement there. And Chevron deference, which is something that Neil Gorsuch, a Donald Trump appointee, yeah, is the leading proponent of breaking apart. Can Trump be this sort of cake uncrusting figure, a bull in a china shop, getting us towards places that we've needed to go? And frankly, that the elite has, in by staying within the 35-yard lines, have failed to get us towards.
Well, I could say he's the stopped clock that's right twice a day. But I would say several things. Yeah. Gorsuch and the courts. Trump probably got elected because Scalia died. That is, he made the court central, and one in according to exit polls, one in five voters said they voted because of the court, and most of those were conservatives. But he got elected because he says, I promise not to exercise my judgment about judges. I'm going to outsource that to the Federalist Society. As a result, he came up with judges that any Republican president would have come up with. Same source from the Federalist Society, and of which I'm a member, and other groups. I think the reaction against Iraq and before that Vietnam was mature before Donald Trump came along and discovered that it was a good vehicle. Mm-hmm. So I think history, hard, cruel, bloody history, taught us long before Mr. Trump appeared.
I see critiques of you and your book in this moment of discussion from the left, congealing, as a lot of discussion does from the left these days, around the issue of race or immigration or some kind of tribalism, which is to say, okay, Mr. Conservative, have you not noticed that this has been in the Republican playbook forever, preceding Donald Trump? Mitt Romney played from an anti-immigration playbook for sure.
And lost.
And lost. Mm-hmm.
One of the uglier ideas in modern American politics was Romney's self-deportation. We'll make people who are here illegally so miserable they'll want to leave. An unworthy aspiration.
Is there something about the... I mean, this goes back to Goldwater. He might have had perfectly principled ideas to oppose the Civil Rights Act, and I think did, as expressed. The coalition around him might not have shared his highfalutin ideas about political philosophy, and we're looking for an excuse to engage in racism. Is there something, or how would you respond to the critique of that a lot of modern conservatism, including to some degree a fealty towards classical liberalism and a throwback to the founders, is looking the other way while a powerful class marginalizes those who are not as powerful?
I think the criticism is apt of a lot of people, but not of conservatism.
Okay.
They should go back and read Ronald Reagan's farewell address. A nation needs walls, but the walls should have gates and should have doors, and the doors should be wide open to those who want to come in and be Americans. William Howard Taft said much the same thing. So there's that continuity on the Taft, Goldwater, Reagan strand of the Republican Party, unlike the Teddy Roosevelt, Thomas Dewey, Rockefeller wing of the party, this simmering, like a sine wave, it keeps coming and going, argument in the Republican Party. Most conservatives are equipped with the vocabulary to admire immigration, because to immigrate is an inherently entrepreneurial act. It is to uproot yourself, take a risk, take the only capital you've got, which is your enterprise, and come to a foreign society where you'll be linguistically challenged and culturally disoriented and prosper, which they do. Furthermore, it's another thing about which Americans have no choice. Sorry, the workforce is aging. Baby boomers are retiring. We very soon will have 2.4 workers for every retiree on Social Security. We must replenish the workforce, and only immigrants can do it as our fertility rate continues to decline.
Do you see this future, and you write a lot about this, the kind of entitlement math that just, it can't possibly add up. So my parents and relatives are all from Portland, Oregon. So I remember watching Mount St. Helens blow up for the second or third time in July of 1980. It was pretty great. Mm-hmm. But volcanoes go like this, they go like this. Everyone says, hey, look, it's growing. That's interesting. It grows, and then it blows up. And then, you know, Harry Truman dies on the Tualatin River. But like it can be a big boom and a catastrophic event, mm-hmm. or you could be Japan the last 20, 30 years. You lose one decade. It's a slow leakage mm-hmm. of power and influence. Maybe you could say that the modern UK is in a similar way. How do you look at this thing?
I don't see an explosion, a collapse. Nations really don't go bankrupt. I do see a sort of drift into a kind of entropy, a kind of slowing of the American pulse, as we make all kinds of adjustments to avoid all kinds of hard choices. We are going to have to means test entitlement programs sooner or later. We have attached the American people as a matter of entitlement to our most dynamic science, which is medicine. Let me give you a couple interesting figures. In 1900, if we'd had national statistics, which we didn't because Simon Kuznets had not yet lived, medicine, which is now 18% of our GDP, would have been too small to be included in them. In 1900, the American people spent twice as much money on funerals as they did on medicine. In 1900, 37% of all deaths were from infectious diseases. Today, it's 2%. In 1900, only 17% of deaths were over 65, people over 65. Today, it's 75%. That's an enormous social achievement. It also is hugely expensive. Longevity is a budgeter's nightmare because you live long enough, you get to become eligible for the most interesting cocktail of diseases. I forgot, something like 40% of American Medicare patients are living with two or more chronic ailments, any one of which would have killed them before the onset of modern pharmacology. Another great blessing, but an expensive one. So the American people have made another choice. They've decided to live long and to be supported in this by a government. They're going to have to figure out ways to pay for it.
You mentioned Richard Nixon earlier, or the kind of crisis of Watergate that was was dealt with. A lot of people don't know the intellectual history, at least a little tiny wing of it, in which you played a role, which is you were a young National Review reporter at the time, or Washington correspondent at the time, 1971, or 72, 73, writing things that were not making the readers of National Review necessarily very happy in your critique of Richard Nixon at the time. I want you to make the comparison not of Trump to Nixon, of which it is an interesting comparison, but let's shelve that, because I think what's kind of interesting here is how Republican public opinion or conservative public opinion was with the president, like strongly for a really long time until the moment that it wasn't. And there's a lot of habits of mind that go with that sense of tribalism or team membership or just sort of support. Looking back on that time, do you see things that strike you as what's happening now?
There are a lot of conservatives who weren't really with Nixon heart and soul until it became clear he was a crook.
Oh.
I'll tell you what. In 1973, I leave the Senate staff in January and become a Washington, Bill Buckley's first Washington editor of National Review, and simultaneously began submitting columns to the Post, which was planning to start a syndication, and they were going to syndicate me and David Broder. So they said, here's how we can sell Will. We'll say to editorial page editors across the country, at last, someone who will support Richard Nixon. Yeah, you think it's funny. By about March of 73, I'm into this business 3 months, and it's quite clear to me that where there's smoke, there's a lot of smoke. And where there's a lot of smoke, there's going to be a fire. And it was clear to me that Nixon was guilty of, at a minimum, failure to superintend the excesses of his subordinates, which is an impeachable offense, in my judgment. So 40-some years later, I'm right back where I started, at having difficulties with a Republican president.
But then in those moments, you get the strange new respect from the liberal media, right?
Well, I can do without that, frankly. National Review at that time, as I recall this, my memory may be faulty, would do an analysis of their mail, and they do a memo on it. And there was a category, subscription cancellations and George Will. They were the same thing. And Bill Buckley, to his great credit, National Review then as now, but then even more than now, depended on the largesse of true believers, many of whom supported Nixon. And as I say, many of whom didn't really warm to him until he became embattled by people that these people, these Nixon supporters, disliked more than they really liked Nixon.
Which, in fact, happened in a sense under Bill Clinton as well. I mean, the impeachment process brought out progressives, self-identified progressives, really for the first time in 1998. Yes. They were They didn't like the way that he triangulated. He was a third way guy. He was a sister soldier moment person. But it was only then, because we saw all the troglodyte conservatives come after him, that we will come and. What do you do with that knowledge, that this is how people respond to politics? And I'll maybe append to that of, did you see the rise in the election of Trump, but just that the Trumpian moment as a bit of a wake-up call for how people in our business do our work and analyze things and synthesize things?
Yes. Increasingly, partly because of what are called social media and should be called anti-social media, we live increasingly in intellectual silos, and we're increasingly subject to confirmation bias, learning exactly what we want to learn from sources we pick because we only want to learn from them. And it's dumbing down the public conversation, there's no question.
And so what do you do with that information, or knowing how people respond to things, and including knowing how people responded to Richard Nixon, rallying around the person because he's embattled more than adhering to an idea? Does this just mean that people of principle are doomed to be a Justin Amash floating around as a despised character over on the side?
It means there always are in society a large number of people who, if they didn't have situational ethics, they'd have no ethics at all. And that's what they are, and get over it. Not that many people interested in philosophic argument. A large number of Americans are, but a larger number of Americans aren't. So you have to nourish those who nourish the conversation about first principles. And my book is in part a summons to intelligent pessimism, but not fatalism. And there are so many things that can go wrong, but the grounds for optimism is that the political philosophy that I call the conservative sensibility has an enormously long and distinguished pedigree, going back just in this country to after Locke, to Madison and Jefferson and Hamilton, and most of all Lincoln. And that just doesn't go away because someone got more than 270 electoral votes. It just doesn't work that way.
In fact, you see people in the throes of any hyper-partisan moment, which for now it's permanent with us, whoever is basically losing an argument goes to the founders, right? Or if they're losing an argument or waging an argument against the president.
The conservative insight, in two words, is nothing less. Nothing. You try and make things last as long as possible. But you also, that's consoling also in times like these. Hyper-partisanship won't last forever. Just won't. People will get exhausted. They'll get burnt over. And there'll be better days.
Before we let you walk to your next 37 interviews talking about this book, you and I, Nick Gillespie, talked, I believe, in 2016, early 2016, in which you observed that we're kind of living not through a libertarian moment, but an authoritarian moment, is the way that you put it. And we see some of this mapping out, again, not just in the United States, the recent European Parliament elections, Greens, nationalists, and the little center was just withering and getting small. Do you think we're going to get out of this fever when you look and see a Democratic Party that is much more interested in democratic socialism and expanding the Supreme Court? I think half the field wants to do now these days. Just a series of ideas that seem a lot more untethered towards norms here, after the norm-shattering present on the sort of populist right. Is this just a bracketed era that we need to survive? What do you see in the near future as far as that?
Well, in the near future, right now, we're seeing in the Democratic field of candidates an attempt to define a left-wing Trumpery, that is to be just as silly as possible. All these things that they know are not going to happen, not going to abolish the Electoral College, not going to take away private health insurance, just not going to do it. But because of the dynamics of their nominating process, they feel they have to do this. Now, they can, in the process, repeat their amazing achievement of 2016, which was electing Donald Trump. He could not have done it without the Democratic Party. And they have figured out how to do it again. Whether or not they're going to plunge off that cliff, lemming-like, I don't know.
You quit, if I'm not mistaken, the Republican Party.
Oh, yes.
In 2016 or in 2015?
2016, June 3rd, the day after Paul Ryan endorsed Trump, I said, that's it. The only Republican who's actually read the Constitution of Liberty has endorsed Trump. And I said, I'm out of here.
And you've written favorably about Bill Weld, who's competing against Donald Trump in this primary election. So are you backing him? Do you envision coming back to the Republican Party? Is it all Libertarian Party for you from now on?
I find being a free agent exhilarating. People say, oh, gee, that must have been wrenching leaving the Republican. My identity would tied up with the Republican Party. It's a utilitarian device, and when it quits being useful, I quit. it's not a wrenching psychological, spiritual moment. Politics isn't about spiritual things. So, no, I don't plan to go back to the Republican Party. I like it out here in the cold.
Very good. Well, George Will, thank you so much. Conservative Sensibility. It's the most impactful libertarian book of the year, despite not having it in the title. Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you.